Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. A lot of people inside and out of the legal world have been talking about the First Amendment in recent weeks. Freedom of speech and assembly are fundamental American rights. But when that freedom was put to the test in Charlottesville, or a Missouri state senator made what most consider an unacceptable comment, or when a grand juror in a controversial case wanted to tell all, it brought that First Amendment into focus once again. This is just some of what we'll be talking about today with our Legal Roundtable panel. Joining me in studio are attorneys Bill Freivogel, journalism professor at SIU in Carbondale. Mark Smith is associate vice chancellor and dean for career services at Washington University. And Rachel Sachs teaches law at Washington University. Rachel, nice to have you back with us.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
And gentlemen, always good to see you. Let's talk with what is close to being breaking news. It's not quite 24 hours old that Governor Greitens has decided to issue a stay of execution in the Marcellus Williams case, Mark, and is establishing a panel to investigate this case. That seems to me to be a very rare kind of circumstance.
Right, it is rare. I think it happens in the past, but it's not a common thing. So what is happening is he's appointing this panel basically under his power to grant clemency to do a fact-finding. And this panel will have subpoena power. They've said that they'll be able to consider evidence that wouldn't otherwise be admissible in court, and then to give him a report. So in the meantime, we get this stay on the execution while we find this. I think, you know, with this case, you see you know, the governor's responding to this suggestion that the evidence is not there. And I'm not completely clear on whether the DNA evidence, it sounds like, I was looking at the Innocence Project brief in support of this stay, of this appointment of this committee. And it sounds like there wasn't enough evidence to get DNA on a couple of the samples. And then the one they had partial DNA, which they say doesn't match and could exclude him. But McCullough is disputing all that and saying, no, the evidence is there. And I just don't know enough about what the actual evidence is. But I think you've got this issue of, you know, people opposed to the death penalty. So they're the folks who are saying there's a large racial component to our criminal justice system that's not fair. And then the particular facts in this case all coming together to kind of prompt Governor Greitens to say, well, let's make sure everything's in place before we move forward. Obviously, this is an irrevocable penalty.
I think this was a little surprising to people that the governor did this. I was communicating a little bit with Mike Wolf, who was the special counsel to Carnahan when this board of inquiry was first used.
Former Supreme Court justice.
He was a Missouri Supreme Court justice after having been Carnahan's counsel, and he was making the point that he really thinks it's important that the report of the Board of Special Inquiry is made public. You know, the proceedings are not public, but he thinks that the report should be made public just so to answer any kinds of questions the public has about the guilt or innocence.
Is there any reason to think that it would not be made public?
Well, if you look at Greitens' order, number four, he says, I direct the following. Pursuant, the board shall close all of its proceedings and hold all collected information in strict confidence. So that's not what's going to be happening right now. Yeah. It can always be changed, though.
I guess the prosecutor's claim is that there's, besides the DNA evidence, which, you know, could potentially exclude Williams, that there is other evidence that is, you know, not direct evidence, but sort of circumstantial evidence that was used to convict him, that he had sold Leisha Gale, a reporter at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, that he had sold, and the victim, that he had sold her laptop. Then there were two witnesses who said that he was involved, a jailhouse snitch and a former girlfriend. Apparently, both of them were looking for the $10,000 reward money, and so their testimony is a little bit more dubious. A lot of the unjust convictions in murder cases involve jailhouse snitches who turn out not to be reliable. So there is some evidence other than the DNA that could connect him.
Rachel, Bill indicated this caught a lot of people by surprise. You have an interesting take on this.
Well, when I was reading about this, my mind immediately went to some of the recent developments around race and racial discrimination in the area. You know, the NAACP has issued a travel advisory stating that Missouri may be unsafe for minorities to travel here in large part because of a new state law signed by the governor that makes it harder for employees to win discrimination cases against their employers. And as Mark alluded to, remember, this is a case about Mr. Williams, a black man who was convicted of the horrific murder of a young white woman. And so prosecutors also struck 6 of 7 potential black jurors from the jury pool. So he had 11 white jurors, 1 black juror, which did not reflect the racial makeup of the community at the time. And also remember that Mr. Williams had his execution postponed once already by the state Supreme Court in 2015 to allow for this DNA testing. So by appointing a board of inquiry that will include retired judges, I see Governor Greitens putting this one back in the hands of the judiciary, at least for now, and sort of distancing himself from the decision-making process.
Does a case like this ever come to the sense of cruel and unusual punishment in that having execution time set and then canceled and then set and reset and canceled? I mean, at what point could it become or can it become cruel and unusual?
I mean, I don't think anyone has ever successfully made the claim that, you know, because I went right up till midnight before there was a stay to my execution, that's cruel and unusual punishment. It may, in fact, be, you know, to the layman, that sounds like cruel and unusual punishment. But I don't think under the Eighth Amendment that that's ever been a successful claim.
Right. I'm assuming that you knew Lisha Gale.
I did, although I was in Washington most of the time she was at the Post-Dispatch, so I just knew her a little bit.
Yeah. I'm thinking of her family going through this. I mean, it's been 20 years or so, and this thing just keeps coming back again and again and again. Talk about cruel and unusual.
That's very tough. That's very tough. And there was an interesting editorial in the Post-Dispatch, which was sort of took a personal view, you know, saying this is a case that's personal to us at the Post-Dispatch. But I think they were making the point that Lisha Gale herself, under the circumstances, wouldn't have wanted to see this go forward. And I don't know if that's true or not. But
I remember talking to Jennifer Joyce, this is probably 5 or 10 years ago, when they were doing the Innocence Project, and she always said, at least this is what I remember, that, you know, you had to have some evidence to make it worthwhile because you had these family members who were waiting for some kind of conclusion. And to just put it off where there wasn't evidence or whatever. And so I would imagine that influences some of the prosecutors. One thing we didn't note about apparently the state of Missouri is ready to go forward. I guess they have 34 doses of the agent, I forgot what it is. I think phenobarbital, is that what it is?
Pentobarbital,
I think. And I guess they would use 2 for the execution. But, I mean, they have a limited amount of this stuff.
Rachel, do you have any sense of how long it's going to take this panel?
I don't. I'm sure it depends on the kinds of information they're going to want to gather, the kind of people they're going to want to speak to. Some of them may, no longer be available, or the memory of, you know, decades ago may be a loss. So I don't. I'll continue to watch and to see the news reports.
And the broader context is Missouri is one of the leading states now in executing people.
Right up there with Texas.
They're supposed to look at all the evidence that was at trial, and then they have subpoena power so they can bring in more evidence. Mm-hmm. So it may take a while.
Yeah.
And we don't know who the members are yet.
No.
Well, let's move on. We've had plenty to discuss today. Rachel, I'll start with you on this one, if you don't mind, and that is Senator Nadal has been getting a lot of publicity because of the comments she made on Facebook, basically saying she'd think it would be a good idea if someone assassinated President Trump. Is this, in your mind, the same thing, a comment like that on social media, the same thing as yelling fire in a crowded theater?
You know, I think it's her comments were completely unacceptable, and I think I share the view of a number in the Democratic leadership that they are grounds for resignation. I'm not sure if it's technically the same as shouting fire in a crowded theater. We might also look at the narrow way in which courts have viewed incitement. I think it would be iffy, to say the least, for a court to come to that conclusion, but it can still be completely unacceptable and yet be legal.
I raised that issue, Bill, because of the First Amendment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Obviously, that's an issue here.
And I would agree with Rachel that it's very unlikely that what she said, which was sort of a wish that Trump were assassinated, that would be grounds for a criminal prosecution. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can even remember back during the presidential campaign, President Trump himself made some comments relating to Second Amendment people and Hillary Clinton that were interpreted in a similar kind of fashion. So, you know, my bottom line is what she said was terrible. She shouldn't have said it. It's grounds for her to be expelled. I can't help but feel a little bit uncomfortable that, you know, the first person we're expelling is an African-American woman who has oftentimes been a thorn in the side of people. I can remember her coming in here, Don, with, her little flat board of Nixon.
Ferguson, post-Ferguson.
Post-Ferguson, yeah. Feeling like he wasn't really leading. And she's been, you know, very involved in that Westlake landfill situation. So she's done some good things, and she's willing to say controversial things. This one went way beyond where she should go.
It's cost her all of her committee assignments already, and as you say, the jury is still out ultimately on whether or not she'll be kicked.
Yeah, well, the Democrats have run away from her.
Yeah.
And she's not, you know, she wasn't popular with the Democrats in the first place, and because she's sort of a thorn in their sides as well. Yeah. I can't help but the thing that causes me to just have a little bit of second thoughts is I'm old enough to remember when the Congress kicked out Adam Clayton Powell. Uh-huh. And just about everybody thought, hey, that's a great idea, kick him out. Because, you know, he was involved in some shady stuff, and Supreme Court said, no, you know, you really can't do that. But I think here the Missouri legislature can
It would be a rare event for a legislature expel someone. Okay, Mark, unless you have something to add to that, I'm going to move on and take a break, come back, continue our conversation. It's Legal Roundtable Day, and our lawyers in studio are Bill Freivogel, Mark Smith, and Rachel Sachs. Back to continue the conversation in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Charlottesville. Where the heck do we start in terms of the legal issues concerning Charlottesville? I mean, we've got, I guess, freedom of assembly is in there somewhere.
Right. Freedom of speech, obviously.
So
one thing I would start with is this idea, you know, people, it's always easy to have 20/20 hindsight. I think they're saying, why didn't they stop these guys from having the march, you know, where they did? And my understanding is what happened where there were two applications for permits to go to the park, what's the name of it now?
Emancipation Park,
which used to be, I guess, Robert Lee Park. And they granted them both and then later rescinded the one to the Nazis and the KKK. And that is content. You know, you can't say we're going to let one group come and not the other group, no matter how much you hate the group. Mm-hmm. There are other reasons that you can say it's dangerous. And I think there were reasons they wanted to be at that park because of the Robert E. Lee connection. So I think
That's why a federal judge said
you got to let them in.
Although, to be fair, did they try to cancel or did they try to move them? I thought
they tried to move them, but they only moved one.
Yes. Okay. Well, although I think charitably you could say they tried to separate the two groups.
Yeah. Yeah. But they would say I think that we wanted to be there because you changed the name of this park, and we want to. That's what we want to protest. So we want to be there.
Right.
So, Bill?
Another thing that as you were saying, Don, there's all sorts of things this involves. Yeah. And another thing it involves is I think that the First Amendment demonstrations in a divided time like this, and also in a time when we have expanded Second Amendment rights, and then even beyond whatever the Second Amendment gives you, we have all these states that permit open carry.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so, you know, how does one address big, divisive protests with counter demonstrators where one or both sides feels as though they have has a legal right to carry long guns? Many states, I think about 40 states, have passed laws that say their local jurisdictions cannot pass, like cities, like Charlottesville, can't pass a law saying no guns at protest demonstrations.
Right.
So that's another issue. And then I think the most important issue is the way President Trump reacted in his and continues to react as late as his speech last night in Phoenix, where he has just, to my point of view, has totally failed to live up to the test of a president exerting some moral authority.
How would you factor in, how could you factor in the Second Amendment gun issue with First Amendment freedom of assembly?
Well, one thing, states should pass laws that permit local jurisdictions to deny carry rights to protesters, to people who are receive permits for protests.
So to be a little bit clear about this, I'm not sure it's exactly a Second Amendment issue, because I don't think the Second Amendment guarantees the right to open carry assault rifles. So
a state issue.
Right. Yeah. So in states like Virginia that allow that, it's one thing. But in other states, white supremacist icon Richard Spencer has been asking to speak at other universities now. And one of those is the University of Florida, which has now denied his request. But I don't believe Florida allows you to open carry long guns. Mm-hmm. So in other states, there might be a different characteristics here, but I do agree that because the government can regulate the time, place, and manner of protests, of speech in public places, the government is surely well within its rights, not just to limit open carry in general, but to specifically limit it in the context of public demonstrations that are expected to have a certain number of people or draw crowds of this type.
Right, but I think they probably, local governments probably cannot do that in the 40-plus states where they're by statute, you're right, statute, not by Second Amendment, where by statute they have the right to carry those guns. You're right, Florida and Illinois and California are three states that don't permit that.
Although, interestingly, some of these state laws allow college campuses to ban open carry.
Right.
So in Texas, which I believe allows open carry, Texas A&M could say, we're not going to have open carry on campus during one of these demonstrations, which is another one that was planned.
And the University of Missouri, I guess, could say, there are no guns on this campus, no guns at demonstrations on the campus.
Mm-hmm. One of the things, this is not necessarily a legal issue, but if you, what we saw happening in Boston, it's putting heavier burdens on the police. And so I think the police in Boston, created this huge, 30-foot kind of no man's land where the counter protesters and the protesters were separated from each other.
A buffer zone,
buffer zone. Yeah, exactly. And that's probably a pretty smart move. It's interesting, the Southern Poverty Law Center has come out with some recommendations for how to respond for universities, how to respond to hate speech on campus. And, we should note that private universities have a lot more discretion than public universities, although most private universities have embraced free speech is one of their core tenets, so they don't want to be monitoring or keeping people out based on content. But having said that, one of the things Southern Poverty Law Center recommends is having a counter protest, but not at the same place, not giving more attention to the group that's kind of the fringe group, the right, the KKK Nazi group, and instead having a counter protest in a different area to try and, I think, minimize the chance of confrontation and also minimize the attention the other group's given. But I think some people don't like that approach because it's viewed as, well, we can't ignore this. It's viewed as letting it be, and mm-hmm. and that maybe we shouldn't do that.
And I just have to, you know, go back to President Trump, who, you know, after his initial statement of both sides having some responsibility, and then after his unhinged press conference two days ago, in Trump Tower, and then last night, where he pulls these remarks out of his coat and blames the press for causing all of the, you know, the divisiveness and for inaccurately quoting him, and then helps lead the chant of people in the audience shouting at the press corps that's in the room. I mean, this is not what you're supposed to do in the United States.
No.
Well, we're getting a lot of it lately, it certainly seems. Anybody else have a thought with regard to Charlottesville?
Yeah, just a couple of notes to remind all of our listeners who may not be lawyers that the First Amendment gives you the right to speak freely, but it does not give you the right to avoid consequences for your speech. And if your private employer decides to fire you for it, or your classmates decide to shun you for it, that is entirely permissible. And in some cases, I think there's a really good argument that your private employer almost has to fire you, right? If you are chanting that Jews will not replace us, if you are shouting racial or misogynistic epithets, you may be creating a hostile work environment for women and minorities that have to work with you or report to you.
I think that's exactly right. But I would also note there is this idea under the NLRB about where you're trying to change your work conditions. Now, I don't see any way that the KKK folks could be protected under that. But I do think if somebody went out to protest what we're doing about immigration or work, and because we feel like it'll have an impact on the workplace, those people might be protected under kind of this concerted action idea. So, but I completely agree with Rachel. I mean, these folks who are coming back, although there was a student who was at, I think, UNLV.
A public university.
Yeah, so that's public, so they can't do anything. Yeah. But I think a private school could say, you don't embrace our ideals. We're going to
I'm not so sure about that. I want to. As a law professor, I like hypotheticals. So he's a student. They clearly cannot expel him, but he's also an employee, I believe. And I don't know in what capacity he's an employee of the university, but I can imagine some positions that he might have where it might be detrimental to his job, to the jobs of others around him, to keep him in that position.
Are you suggesting he would create a hostile work environment?
Or you know, if he truly holds all of these racist beliefs, what if he's a TA and he's grading students and there's a subjectivity in grading? Mm. Or what if he's a peer counselor and he's learning sort of sensitive information about some of his students? I'm just trying to wonder, you know, that might be different from a library card swiper.
But I'd say that in general, so this was a person who was at the white supremacist rally. He was identified around by this Twitter campaign of trying to out the white supremacists and neo-Nazis who were there. But by the way, a campaign that becomes sort of like an online vigilante campaign. They have sometimes been identifying people who were not, in fact, there.
Right.
It can be dangerous.
Dangerous, and also will subject them to libel suits.
Sure.
So this was a student from and worker at the University of Nevada?
Reno.
And so the university said, we don't agree with him, but we can't expel him, as 10,000 people wanted him to be expelled. I think that is clearly right.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't think even as a worker, maybe not even as a TA, you know, could he be fired for doing something in Charlottesville, for being at a Nazi white supremacist protest in Charlottesville? Could he be fired if he hadn't done anything within the university that amounted to kind of hateful, you know, harassing.
I think there's clearly an argument for it. I think it would depend on, you know, what his role is within the university. And as a public employee, you know, you do have First Amendment rights to speak out on matters of public concern. You know, Mark mentioned this idea of immigration policy. Mm-hmm. That is very different from advocacy for white supremacist positions and neo-Nazi positions. So if your speech is highly disruptive to the work environment, if you cannot continue to work with your colleagues because of what you've been saying, even if not in the purview of your employment, I could see an argument that you could be fired or at least reassigned for that, even if you do work for a public employer.
And if he were posting all over Facebook, so it becomes, it's outside of work, and he's, but, I mean, I think it could go either way, because, you know, what you're saying, Bill, is it's not within the workplace. He says all these hateful things outside and talks about how these people shouldn't be working here, but then at work, he just does his job and he keeps his mouth shut. But I mean, particularly with the internet, what you say outside of work is now, it's not like he's just saying it to his group of racist friends in this house, and it's other people are not hearing it.
You know, I would just want to add, though, that, you know, as one thing I think that liberals need to be concerned about, and need to sort of, and I put myself in the class of liberals, to examine themselves about is, you know, is being afraid, trying to block the speech of people that we hate, these Nazis and white supremacists based on the content, you know, trying to keep them off of college campuses as speakers, you know, Berkeley denying, was it Ann Coulter?
I think it was
Ann Coulter after the Milo episode.
Milo episode. I mean, I think they've totally mishandled both of those situations. And I think, you know, I mean, part of liberalism, part of true classical liberalism is the belief in free speech and that, you know, if we allow a lot of speech, it's going to get us to the best place in the end. It's going to be a pathway to truth.
And to kind of force yourself to substitute for whatever group that you don't like, a group you do like or that you're more comfortable with. So if it's we're banning communists or we're banning Black Lives Matter instead, are you comfortable with that? And I think that point's well, very well taken. Another thing that's kind of interesting is apparently some of the web providers, the what do you call them? The internet providers, I guess, like GoDaddy has now dropped
violating their terms of service.
Yeah, and so
which they can clearly do because they're not government. So the First Amendment doesn't apply to them.
But as the internet service providers becomes a smaller and smaller group, it becomes, you know, I mean, that's a major way of communication. How do we feel about that?
Well, we've said many times a lot of law is yet to be written going on in the internet. I mean, it's still in the very early stages, although that's hard to believe sometimes, given the widespread use. Let's move along as time begins to advance here. There's another issue I guess we would call free speech, and this concerns that grand juror in the Darren Wilson case. Wilson, of course, the police officer who shot Michael Brown 3 years ago. What this juror, and I keep wanting to call it a she, but we don't know if it's male or female. Do we?
Well, the briefs are using she.
Oh, really?
Her,
okay.
So I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah. Well, in any case, that's really not the point. Being is this grand juror wants to be able to talk about what transpired during the grand jury session here, and the rules prohibit that. Once again, are we talking a First Amendment right here?
Maybe not. I guess we'll find out. So I think the juror is making the argument that, first of all, because McCullough gave a press conference in which he said it was a collective decision of the grand jury not to indict, and because he then also released large portions of grand jury transcripts, that sort of waives the whole grand jury secrecy, claim. And so it's waived by the state. And so she should be able to be free from her oath of secrecy that she took to be a grand juror.
To basically dispute McCullough's narrative of what happened.
The narrative of what happened. And then the second claim is that the First Amendment, if under the First Amendment, she has a First Amendment right to speak because the public's knowledge of this very important case and how it was resolved outweighs any kind of state interest in keeping the grand jury process secret.
I think we'd all like her to speak.
Well, and the concern is, what the McCullough's office has said is, the concern is that she will release the names of other grand jurors who, and the names of witnesses. And so the idea is we offered these people secrecy and privacy so they would come forward, tell their story under the, under the understanding that they wouldn't be then held up later and that they would be able to do what they think is right without fear of public reprisal.
I'm not sure why that's a realistic concern. I'm not sure why her speech to rebut the prosecutor's statements about what he did or did not do in the grand jury. I'm not
would affect that.
Yeah, right. I think those could absolutely be limited, right? I think I don't see a conflict between an oath of secrecy as it relates to those very sensitive facts and a limited right to say, actually, you are misrepresenting publicly what you did behind closed doors.
Right, and judges do that kind of stuff all the time. Yeah. They say, okay, we're going to let you have this information, but you can't disclose these names. And so, yeah, it seems like they could divide the baby here and come up with a solution that maybe is workable.
The Missouri Court of Appeals has the issue now, as I understand
yeah,
it.
Yeah, she has lost in the lower court.
Right. What if he or she,
the juror has lost the lower court.
What if that juror spoke anyway and just started rambling on about what went on? What would happen? What would the penalty be?
I believe that there's for on one of these statutes there's a criminal penalty I think the juror could be prosecuted. Plus, then I think there's the potential for contempt of court that the St. Louis County courts that impaneled the grand jury could try to bring.
Do you know if it's a fine or jail time?
I don't know.
Because if it's a fine, I can imagine
people would pay it
the
for
ACLU or someone stepping sure. up and saying, we'll pay the fine. Absolutely. Yeah, say what you want.
You know, I wonder, Rachel, under your – so I can see – I agree that maybe the courts could put together and say, you can talk about this, this, and this, and you can't talk about yeah. that. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, would the juror be able to talk about what the vote was?
Well, I think we sort of know what the vote was, don't we? Because the prosecutor has made – we know how many it takes to
– Nine.
Nine. And so presumably it was
– There weren't nine.
Right.
But I mean, I think right. you could –
But what
could
if she
add.
Said there were eight to indict?
You know, I'm not sure that that's information that's critical to be made public. I do think it's critical if the information that he or she wants to make public is something along the lines of – the prosecutor, in fact, did not do everything.
And that everyone they said was they confused. And it wasn't that we came to a understanding, things like
right.
that, like he's
right.
trying yeah. to say.
We've got to take another break, but it occurs to me if, in fact, she were allowed to speak or he or she were allowed to speak, that it would make the grand jury system a shambles in terms of would this not be a precedent that would allow any grand juror in any case to talk?
I think this is kind of a one-off situation.
Certainly the way McCullough handled it was a one-off situation. But I mean, we got to remember that the grand jury process in the federal system is there. That's in the Bill of Rights, and it's there
to protect the
defendant. Mm-hmm. So that, like, if somebody's bringing false claims, that they're not going to get out there and be public if it turned out not to be true.
Got to take that break. Let's do that now. Continue the Legal Roundtable panel discussion in a moment. My guests in studio, Rachel Sachs of Washington University School of Law, Mark Smith, also of Washington University, and Bill Freivogel of SIU in Carbondale. Back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back. It's our Legal Roundtable panel discussion day. And here we go with, I think, is a very interesting story because of what it could perhaps presage. Let me just read a news account of what we're going to be talking about. Next month, a delegation of state lawmakers will travel to Phoenix to attend what organizers say will be the first formal convention of states since the Civil War. They'll gather at the Capitol and draw up rules for a hoped-for future meeting, a convention to draft an amendment to the U.S. Constitution. And the amendment that they would particularly be interested in would be a balanced budget amendment, supposedly. but that could open up a Pandora's box, I think. What do you think about this? Here we go. This is the potential for a constitutional convention. Rachel, you can't wait. You can't wait. I see that.
I am so confused. Okay, so this may be a very naive question, but having read the article, I really don't think it's obvious that you need a constitutional convention to do all of the things that these advocates want. So if you want to balance the federal budget, why not just elect representatives, senators, a president who will do that? And so maybe you say, well, we have to get enough states to do that. But it takes 3/4 of the states, it takes 38 of them to ratify a constitutional amendment. But it only takes a majority of the House, maybe 60 votes in the Senate to actually do that. That's fewer people. So why do we need a constitutional convention here? Any thoughts?
No, I think that's a very good question.
I mean, I guess the answer, I agree with you, but the answer to that would be, well, yeah, but we've been trying to elect people who will balance the budget, and they never can do it because of the political process.
So we got to drain the swamp by doing this.
So we have a more complex, longer political process to solve the problem. Okay.
And the balanced budget proponents have for years been calling for a constitutional amendment for that.
I mean, I just think this is a terrible idea, particularly if it got beyond a single proposal for a balanced budget amendment. Because, you know, there are all sorts of things that are in the Constitution that aren't particularly popular and people would want to get rid of, both on the left and on the right.
That's exactly right.
I mean, how would conservatives, feel about it if, you know, suddenly, we're going to change the Second Amendment, right to bear arms, and how you know, people, what we've just been talking about hate speech. Maybe we just need to read hate speech out of the First Amendment. Yeah. Or maybe, you know, just get rid of Citizens United. You know, corporations shouldn't have, the right to unlimited expenditures. So why should criminals have government-paid lawyers? And why should we always, what this cruel and unusual thing is crazy. We should be able to execute juveniles and
or maybe make it clear that you're not supposed to execute. Change it. Things have changed. Yeah. So I think your point is a really good one. That there are things that both sides like in the Constitution that the other side doesn't like, and once you start tinkering with it, who knows what might happen? So I'm kind of. It just seems like a real scary process.
Once they convene, there is apparently, from what I've read, nothing to stop them potentially from bringing anything into the mix. You know, abortion, gay marriage, you name it. Any of these things could be brought up.
Right.
Anyway, this is going to be an interesting thing to watch. I think it's next month where they're going to convene.
I mean, I think I'm right in saying this, that the Constitutional Convention itself, you know, they were supposed to fix the Articles of Confederation, but they decided to write themselves a whole new Constitution. I mean, in a way, I sort of hate to say that, well, we're not as qualified as founding fathers, many of whom, as we've been talking about recently, were slaveholders. Mm-hmm. And certainly the original Constitution had that horrible blotch of the 3/5 compromise on the very first page. You know, couldn't we do better now? But I think we couldn't.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, the other thing that I... apparently the most popular model for a constitution for different countries around the world is not the United States Constitution. It's the Canadian Constitution.
Yeah, exactly.
But I kind of like our U.S. one. I'm like nostalgic or whatever the word. I'm partial to it, and I let's not screw around with it.
Well, I also should point out that these are representatives from state legislatures all over the country, and most of the state legislatures in the country are Republican-led. There would be, if I might say so, sort of a right-wing conservative bent to any kind of a meeting like this.
And even like Bill said, with the Constitutional Convention, you know, they're supposed to fix the articles. They come up with a whole new thing, and then they have to go immediately back because they forgot a bunch of stuff, and then we get the Bill of Rights, you know? Yeah. So that's not the most charitable way to put it, but kind of what happened.
We'll see. It's going to be fun to watch that, see how that develops. We have a number of other things I'd like to talk about. We also have a number of callers, and let's bring them in, and we can talk about some of the other things another time. And we'll start with Tom, who's calling from St. Louis. Tom, you've been very patient. Thank you for waiting. Are you there?
Thanks, Don.
Yeah.
Yes. Thanks, Don. I have seen in social media a lot of arguments from activist community on the left or progressive end of the spectrum saying that argument that hate speech, because it advocates genocide or the denial of rights on the basis of ethnicity, that it shouldn't be protected speech under the First Amendment. And I've been very surprised at how many people, especially in the under 40 age group, support that view. It's not the traditional view. It's not the ACLU argument. And these people are attacking the ACLU from the left. And I just wonder if your panel sees any gaining acceptance for that point of view. As
Tom, thank you so much. I'm interrupting. Sorry to do that, but we'll save some time that way. What do you think? Anybody have a thought?
Rachel's the only one under 40. Let's
yeah, her speak. Yeah, I'm under 40. I also have a lot of students under 40, and I highly doubt that law students are representative of the broader population. But, you know, I agree with Tom that I've seen that discourse online, but I haven't seen it in my students, and I really haven't seen it in the younger generation today. I don't see it among my peers. I think it's certainly true that there are some people who hold that belief, but you know, the free speech right, it's right there in the First Amendment. So,
but well, my students at SIU Carbondale may be a different matter. I yesterday in my First Amendment class with 38 students, I asked them the question: how many of you think the First Amendment should protect the hate speech of the neo-Nazis and white supremacists in Charlottesville? And only one person, very hesitantly, like he was afraid to put his hand up, put his hand up. So, yeah, I sort of, I'm a little bit with the caller. I'm concerned about this. And, you know, just to clarify, so the First Amendment clearly does protect hate speech. You know, a Ku Klux Klaner burning a cross in a farm field, burning the American flag as a method of protest, burning the Bible, burning the Quran. All these things are hate speech that's protected by the First Amendment. It's just when it, you know, gets to like inciting toward violence that you know, like if you take a cross and you go right up to a African-American family's front door and you burn it, now that probably isn't protected.
Yeah, although, you know, I think there's a question here about what it means to protect the speech, right? I think if you asked someone who's not a lawyer, not a law student, what does it mean that the First Amendment protects your right, they might have a different understanding than what we've been talking about, which is no one has to listen to you. You can be fired. You can lose all of your friends, your job, your reputation. But it's still protected speech in the sense right. that you can say it in public.
Was I also think sometimes with young people, I mean, I remember being, I don't know if it was high school or college, when the Skokie Nazi march was coming through. Mm-hmm. I must have been in high school. And they said, what do you think about this? They're going to go through. There's Holocaust survivors. And I just remember as an 18-year-old thinking, well, that's wrong. That's bad. And I guess it took law school for me to realize there's moral right and wrong, and then there's legal right, right and wrong,
yeah.
and they're not the same. They're different.
That's right.
And so I think it's good that our students sometimes go with the moral answer, and I agree with them. But then we talk about, well, let's tease that out. How would that work for other things? And trying to get – it's a subtle – complicated process, and people don't always like subtle and complicated.
Was it John Hancock who says, I reject totally what you say, but I'll fight to the death for the right to say it. Yeah.
I mean, we don't need a First Amendment to protect speech that people like.
Exactly.
We can take this up at the amendment convention when we're rewriting the Constitution. Let's bring in Lawrence calling from Veronica Park. Lawrence, you've been very patient, so thank you.
Very much, Mr. Marsh, and greetings to your panel. I'm going to bring us back to Ms. Chappelle Nadal. What she did was really stupid. Once again, she embarrassed her fellow Democrats, which is not surprising. She's all, as a Democrat, I do not care for her. She, in the past, has worked with up there with people, and she's done things, but let's put that aside. If she resigns, that's her business. But I have a problem with a special session or any session where they're going to expel her. She has not been convicted of a crime. If the Secret Service has interviewed her, they've obviously found her to be an obnoxious innocent, like Ted Nugent when he said the things he said when Barack H. Obama was running for his second term.
Do you have a proposal, Lawrence? Because our time is running out.
Well, my point is, I'm very, very, I'm very opposed to her being expelled. They've taken her membership and committees away, and they should censor her. but let her finish out her term and see if she's reelected.
Thank you, Lawrence, for the call.
I think I agree. I think censure is probably more appropriate. I sort of think that the blood's in the water, and they're not going to stop short of expelling her. And she actually has an incentive to resign rather than be expelled, because she loses her pension if she is expelled, and she doesn't if she resigns.
I can't see her resigning. This particular personality, I just don't see that myself, but that's just my personal.
I don't know her, but I mean, it's kind of frustrating. These people think that I'm the only person that can do this job. Nobody else can do it. And there are lots of good people out there. They don't always, they're not always in elected office, but, there are other people.
But there are, you're right. There are lots of good people out there.
Yeah, and it's just a slight amendment to Lawrence. Can she run for re-election?
She's term limited
so
out.
So she can
run for another office, but not for the state Senate. Let's take one more call quickly, though. Bob and Milstead, it's your turn, but it has to be quick.
Thank you, sir. Last month I called about whether there was anything in the Constitution that addressed the separation of church and state, and I was told the Establishment Clause in the First Amendment. It always appears to be that it goes from government to religion. Is there anything in the Constitution that protects the public from religion? How far can religion go before it's being forced on the public? Didn't the governor in Missouri just have a special session about abortion? And the president, he's advocating allowing political speech from the pulpit. Those are issues, I think, can you have free speech from the pulpit?
Bob, thank you for the call. Let's get some comment on that. Bill, you're poised to say something.
You're right. The Establishment Clause is what requires separation of church and state and keeps the government from forcing religious views forcing you to believe in a particular religion. That you can't require, and public schools can't have mandatory school prayer, for example. That's an example of the Establishment Clause. Speech from, so like when the president says God save the United States at the end of his speech, that's the president saying it, but that's part of his free speech right. That's part of his free exercise of religion, which is also protected by the First Amendment. You mentioned political speech from the pulpit. That goes to the sort of question of, would a church lose its tax-exempt status by explicitly endorsing particular candidates? And I think President Trump has been trying to not enforce that particular provision of the IRS regulations or code as much as previous presidents have. But even previous presidents have not enforced it to a great extent. So, that's not really a constitutional issue. That's an IRS tax break issue.
We have 1 minute left. Do you have a comment on that, Rachel?
Let me just say that a lot of people, politicians, religion influences their views. I mean, most religions say we ought to help the poor. And so that's not necessarily a bad thing. And if they want to bring those views, I mean, there's, when we start telling people you have to do this because of my religion, but if you can convince other people and you're motivated by your religion, but you convince them on other, I just think that's, many people are religious.
But that's the key, that we are a nation of laws, and that must be justified using secular reasons.
Right.
As you said, you might be motivated. Governor John Kasich of Ohio talks about how he's motivated by his religion to do everything he can to help the poor, and that's why they expanded Medicaid in the state of Ohio. But he justified it on public policy grounds.
Right, exactly.
We ought to leave it right there, folks. Okay. Thank you so much. Interesting discussion today. Lots to talk about that we couldn't get to, but we'll do it next time. Thank you, Bill Frivogel. Great to see you again. Rachel, thank you. Rachel Sachs of Washington U and Mark Smith also from that institution. Archived versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.